Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of June. Yesterday was the 40th anniversary of the birth of the modern gay rights movement, a police raid on the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York. And we're going to be talking about progress or lack of progress on gay issues and equality issues during the course of the first hour today. Our guest is Rick Rosendahl, who's Vice President for Political Affairs, Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance of Washington, D.C. The administration has been criticized. I don't know if you saw Frank Rich's column in Sunday's paper in which he talks about the fact that it's utterly uncharacteristic inarticulateness the president has on this issue. The Justice Department brief defending the Defense of Marriage Act has spoken louder, he writes, for this president than any of his own words on the subject. We'll talk about what came from yesterday's meeting and why there are still political concerns about gay issues and why it is that as a gay Democrat from South Carolina who came within 4 percentage points of winning a congressional seat in November said America is changing more quickly than the government on these issues. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Rick. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address, if you'd like to send an email, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Rick. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell me, what do you hear about what happened with the president yesterday?
Well, first of all, the actual beginning of the Stonewall Rebellion was about 1 a.m. on June 28th, 40 years ago, and then it happened for 6 nights. So this week, basically, it went on for almost a week, and so that observation continues. The president gave a very good speech yesterday. One of the things he talked about was his continued belief that don't ask, don't tell harms our military readiness, and it needs to be repealed by Congress. Now, many of the things that we want from this administration do require acts of Congress, as does repealing the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed into law by President Clinton in the fall of 1996. So everything, you know, isn't something that the president can personally do. But on the 17th of June, he signed a presidential memorandum granting as the domestic partners of gay federal employees, such as myself, I work at the Department of Labor, all of the benefits that he could grant short of additional legislation. And this, for example, helps foreign service officers who are stationed overseas, for example. But there are some things that he could do. And, in fact, I said in a column this past week that one of the things he should do was to speed up the regulations to get rid of the HIV immigration ban, which was signed into law by President Clinton in 1993. The legal part of that was removed, but there's still the regulatory part because there was already an HIV immigration ban before it was made statutory. Just the other day, regs were published in the Federal Register to begin that process of getting rid of the regulatory ban on HIV immigration. So that is the immigration of people that are HIV positive, which is the only disease for which there is an outright ban. It hurts a lot of families, and it doesn't make a lot of rational sense. No other nation has that particular approach. Well, there may be a few like China or something, but the vast majority of nations do not have that policy. And in fact, many people consider America to be an exporter of AIDS. There are certain people over the years that would go on vacations to third world countries such as Thailand. And so the notion that you can simply have, you know, totally block the borders, I mean, it harms people. For example, there's a friend of mine, conservative columnist Andrew Sullivan, who is HIV positive. He's lived in this country for a couple of decades, and he faces potential deportation without the removal of that restriction.
Hmm.
But anyway, so the president is a friend of our community. He has a strong pro-gay legislative record going back to his days in the Illinois Senate. And he demonstrated again a few times this month that he is a friend. The question is how to help him enact his pro-gay agenda. There is a lot of people in Congress who are supposedly our friends who seem to lack a backbone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things we have to work on, is to really ramp up the grassroots organizing, making sure that people in districts all across the country convey their concerns to their members of Congress and demand action on a hate crimes bill that's inclusive of sexual orientation and gender identity and expression, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, and then further down the line, Defense of Marriage Act repeal, and even passage of the Uniting American Families Act, which was introduced by Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, which would help couples that one of whom is a foreign national. I myself am in that situation. My partner Patrick was born in Burundi, and he currently is an asylee in Belgium. I helped him escape when his family tried to murder him back in 2002. Mm-hmm. I helped him escape to Europe, but he can only visit here, and that causes a great deal of financial and emotional strain on a family. And I spoke to the president specifically about, when I had a few set moments with him yesterday, I spoke to him and asked him to support the Nadler bill, and he said he hadn't read it yet. I urged him to have a look at it, and he said he would, and then I followed up with a White House staffer about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and that's not a big earth-shaking thing, getting the president to say he'll have a look at a bill, but having a talk with the president is not enough, but it's better to talk with the president than not to talk with him.
Right.
And we have a lot of work to do ourselves to organize.
Right. Let's go back to Defense of Marriage for a moment and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As I was listening to news reports yesterday, it seemed to me as though there was some confusion about whether or not Congress needed to get involved with this or the president could just sign an executive order.
The president has made clear, and I certainly agree, that Congress needs to act. On Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I believe Senate Majority Leader, not acting much like a leader, was saying that the president could take care of it. It's possible for the president to issue a stop-loss order, but if that's going to be taken by Congress as a sign that they can just not step up to the plate on that, then that might be counterproductive. Then there was suggestions that, well, we haven't introduced DOMA yet in Congress because we're not sure it has the votes. If they're not going to do anything until they're certain they have the votes, then that just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we need to press them, even having a test vote before they have everything locked down in terms of enough votes, at least would enable us to identify where the weak spots are. Until they at least are willing to give us the results of whip counts, we're at a disadvantage. We know there are certain members that are weak or vacillating who basically are with, you know, say that they're with us, but then they don't want to step up.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes a vote that you know is going to lose is crucial as part of the long process of getting to the goal. You have to identify who you have to work on, and so some of us are going to be pressing for that in the weeks and months ahead.
What about this statement that America is changing more quickly than the government? The public is much more in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, repealing Defense of Marriage Act than a lot of members of Congress are. They seem to be rather squeamish.
Oh, that's definitely true. I was talking to the head of the Service Members Legal Defense Fund, a fellow named Aubrey, and he was saying the public is very much ahead of members of Congress at this point. They haven't gotten it yet that the voters are ahead of Congress, and we have to convey that to members. You know, one member at a time, one district. You know, or one state at a time, in the case of senators, by making sure that they hear from their constituents. In some cases, on some of these issues, the radical right will stir people up, and so they'll get 10 times as many phone calls, you know, from people who are opposed to the pro-gay position than they hear from our side. And when people are fanatics, and will, you know, drive over their grandmother to get to the polls to vote against us, or that sort of thing, you know, colloquially. It's hard to match that if you're just sort of calm and reasonable and moderate, and you're not obsessed And you're not, you know, saying, well, the country is going to collapse if I don't get my way, which the other side routinely says. So that's part of the problem, is there's a disparity in terms of the sheer level of passion here. So there is there's been an increase in passion on the part of the LGBT community this spring, and impatience. And impatience is a valuable thing if it motivates people to do something other than just to complain and stop giving money to people, to candidates. I think it's legitimate to stop giving money to sort of campaign-wide organizations like the whole Democratic National Committee or things like that. But I've always believed in giving most of my money to individual candidates anyway. You know, like Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin and Keith Ellison in Minnesota is somebody that's been very supportive. And, I mean, I love being able to say that the Congressional Muslim Caucus is pro-gay, for example. And so, I mean, so I've given, you know, money to individual candidates like that. And last year I gave a good deal of money, maybe not in the grand scheme of things that much money, but several hundred dollars I gave personally to Obama. And so it makes sense for people to pull back, but it's not enough to say what we're not going to do. We have to say what we are going to do. We have to organize. We have to communicate. And a lot of times people just are lazy and don't bother writing the letters and making the phone calls, even though it would only take a few minutes to make a phone call. And then there's this impulse to take shortcuts. A call for a march in Washington again, and I think there have been four in the past, this coming October 11th. And that's a holiday weekend, the Columbus Day weekend. That day happens to be traditionally what's called National Coming Out Day. And people are planning to have a big rally on the West Lawn of the Capitol, the other parts of the mall having been taken by others. And what I say is that amounts to having a rally where we talk to ourselves while members of Congress are out of town. And I agree with what my friend Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts says, which is that we should emulate the National Rifle Association. Now, they have much higher numbers than our community could hope to match, given the demographics. But still, NRA works the halls of power relentlessly. And that's what we need to do, and not just have rallies. And as Barney Frank said before the March in Washington in 1993, some people, you know, spend hundreds or maybe thousands of dollars to come to Washington for a big party, but how many of them were willing to spend the cost of a first-class stamp to send a letter to their member of Congress? Because many of his colleagues said that, you know, they don't think they have any gay constituents, at least they never hear from them. And that still is a problem.
It's interesting to me that how many people are not very aware of Stonewall. Can you refresh our minds when it comes to the history that is being marked all of this week?
Yes, there is, by the way, a book by a man named David Carter, published several years ago, about Stonewall, which is a very well respected history of the events in late June 1969. It was not possible for ABC, you know, liquor license establishments in New York that wanted to serve gay people to get licenses. And so they ended up being run by those that would serve gay people would be controlled by the mob, and they would be making, you know, occasionally make payoffs to police in order to be allowed to stay open. And they tended to be filthy and just generally often unsafe and disreputable. And so police raids were fairly routine. And prior to the early morning hours of June 28th, 1969, when the police showed up, people would scatter. And on this particular time, and it was a diverse crowd, there were, you know, sort of homeless people and street hustlers and drag queens and just various people. And this time they didn't back down. They got fed up and did not move. And a bunch of people got arrested, and there were windows broken, and just confrontation with the police. And that went on for several nights. And as people learned about it, they started showing up and observing it and getting involved and that sort of thing. And that was not the beginning of the gay rights movement. That goes back at least to 1950 with the founding of the Mattachine Society on the West Coast. And between 1950 and the late 60s, there were a handful of organizations grew up, some local, some national. But the events of the Stonewall Uprising were a flashpoint that helped widen the movement and get more people involved. Here in D.C. in the early 1960s, Frank Kameny, who's still involved in GLAA today, who's now 84, he had been fired from the Army Map Service in 1957 for being gay. And he fought that in court, lost. The Supreme Court refused to hear his case, and then he took on the battle for others. And he founded the D.C. Mattachine Society in the early 1960s, and he was more militant than people before, who tended to be kind of apologetic and very conservative in their approach and very hesitant. And Frank was more outspoken and challenged policies and said, you know, we will define ourselves. We are not going to let psychiatrists define us or ministers. And we reject that we're sinful. We reject that we're sick. We reject being criminalized. We're not going to accept being raided by the police in our bars when we're doing nothing against anybody. And it was a long period in the wilderness when there was no very little organizational backup for him. There was no gay newspapers. There was not a lot of community groups that were willing to step forward. It was a time of great repression. And there was a few people like Frank Kameny that stood up, and at great cost to themselves. And after 69, that widened considerably. It was, you know, the 1960s and the social ferment. And so Stonewall was part of all of that. And so the gay rights movement was following on the heels of the black civil rights movement and the women's equality movement. And in fact, Frank Kameny in 1968 coined the expression, gay is good, specifically inspired by Stokely Carmichael's having coined the phrase, black is beautiful. And he modeled it after that.
Our guest this hour is Rick Rosendahl, Vice President for Political Affairs for the Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance of Washington, D.C. Yesterday, gay leaders met with, including Rick, President Obama, to talk about a number of issues on this week, and specifically yesterday, which is considered the birth of the gay rights movement, because it was 40 years ago that police raided a gay bar called the Stonewall Inn in New York, and demonstrations took place all this week. So let's welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Paul Sterabin will join us. His book is After America, Narratives for the Next Global Age. All right, let's go to phone calls. We start with Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks. You know, I think in our current circumstances as a country, we need every American we can possibly get to work together with every other American. And I don't mean to stereotype, but I will, because your guest at one point said, describing some of the opposition on this issue as if you're not obsessed. Under this don't ask, don't tell policy for our armed services, for instance, which Barack Obama, President Obama, could, by the stroke of a pen from his office, simply say, we can't do this. We need these linguists who speak Arabic, who read Farsi, who are able to help with our intelligence activities as a nation, and we've been dismissing them. And I think I'm so sick and tired of gay issues being treated as sort of a third rail in American politics, that is, really squeamish politicians who are afraid to say, as Obama did on the campaign trail, no, I do not believe the way some of you believe about gay and lesbian issues, and I'm going to be a strong advocate for these people in our society. He's not going to get my vote if he goes the second time around for a presidential slot. In addition to the Rich article that was Frank Rich article in the New York Times, I just point people's attention to a Leonard Pitts Jr. article in the Wisconsin State Journal yesterday about how will I know the gay demon when I see it. And he's writing about the Manifested Glory Ministries of Bridgeport, Connecticut, who take a 16-year-old boy and subject him to an exorcism in order to rid him of the gay demon which possesses him. There's a lot of sick thinking about who gay people are and what our roles are in the society. And I think we really do have to stand up, as your guest says, and say, this has just got to stop. You absolutely have to regard us as equal Americans who make great contributions to the society and who want to serve in the armed forces and in other capacities. Sorry I went on so long, I just I get very angry when I hear about some of the stuff that is done to treat this as a wedge issue, mm-hmm. which means a wedge is something you split off Americans from other Americans. And we're all Americans, and we all deserve equal treatment, in my opinion. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Let me address that. That basically is two different points that he was making. First, on the social side, it's useful sometimes. It's a lot easier to fight an adversary who manifests himself or herself. And with the case of the radical religious right, and there's nothing really conservative about this. There is a degree of recklessness and harmfulness and inhumane attitudes that cannot fairly be called conservative in the true sense. It's radical. And when you see stuff like that absurd exorcism, so-called exorcism, it's very disturbing, but it's easier to combat this extremism when we can show the YouTube video of it. And we have seen how the Republican Party, which inflamed the religious right to help win elections and exploited it thereby, has been shrinking. It's lost the last two elections. It looks like it's headed to losing a third because of you can't even criticize this without having to, you know, give the next day apologize to Rush Limbaugh. And I think increasing numbers of Americans, you know, realize that first of all these people don't speak for them and are voting against that kind of really disturbing nonsense. And now on the other side, the other point that the fellow was making was about President Obama. I think a distinction has to be made between the president and many of the Democrats in Congress. I just don't think it's true how he characterized the president's words and actions. If we're not going to give the president credit for what he has done, however unsatisfactory it is, you know, then we shouldn't complain if he doesn't do any more. I mean, if he does A, B, and C, and you all you do is denounce him because he didn't also do E, F, and G, you're not being very constructive. And it's crucial that we, under no circumstances, no matter what anybody does, Democrat or Republican, use any of it as an excuse for pulling back or getting less involved. Then we will lose. We have to get more involved. The president has not just signed this presidential memorandum to do what he can do for federal employees. He said that he reiterated his belief that DOMA is discriminatory and urged Congress to repeal it. Yesterday, he himself brought up the linguists in the military and our need for them and the fact that Don't Ask, Don't Tell harms our military readiness, and he urged Congress to repeal that. And he's working with the military to prepare a plan for implementing the repeal once the repeal passes. He urged support for, and he personally endorsed the Domestic Partnership Benefits and Obligations Act, which Tammy Baldwin introduced in the House and Joe Lieberman in the Senate. So he's working, and also he pushed ahead the regulations to end the HIV immigration ban. Now, nobody, including the president, thinks that's enough. He said it's not enough. He asked us to help him push the full agenda through. And the first things that are likely to to get passed in Congress are the Hate Crimes Bill and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. But it's crucial, if you are a reality-based activist, to give whatever credit, and I mean whatever. If it's very little, then fine. You give a little bit credit where it's due, in addition to criticism. I am not for a moment saying that you don't criticize, you don't keep pressing. We have to keep pressing. We have to work from the inside. We have a lot of people on the inside and from the outside, all across the board, all across the country. But I think we need to be constructive about it, and I just don't think it's fair, the degree of disgust that people have with this president after approximately 160 days. Mm-hmm. He's not done yet.
No, he's not. And yet, let me talk a little bit more about this. He has been able to give an exquisitely beautiful speech on race. He gave a stirring speech to the Muslim world. He gives stirring speeches. He moves many, many people. If he viewed this as the great civil rights issue of our times, there is no doubt that he could deliver a speech that was thoughtful, that was important, and that elevated this issue to the great civil rights issue of our time.
He gave one yesterday. He gave a very strong speech yesterday, and I was standing a few yards from him, portions of it were shown on the Rachel Maddow show last night. I'm looking for a full video of it. I haven't found that yet, going out on YouTube and stuff, and whitehouse.gov, I don't know if they post videos of speeches, but the transcript is available on the White House website, whitehouse.gov, on the part where they have transcripts of speeches. They posted the full transcript, and it's a very strong speech. He didn't just reiterate his support, for example, for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but he discussed why it's harmful of our military readiness, of our national security. And he talked about these highly skilled linguists, for example. So he's demonstrated that he gets it. But he also talked about Stonewall a little bit, and talked about how people, advanced our country's, embrace of equality forward by standing up and saying they'd had enough and wouldn't accept this mistreatment any further. And he said, 40 years ago, nobody would have expected you, meaning all of us, or for that matter, me, him speaking of himself, to be, there in the East Room of the White House. There was a news conference back in like 1962 when one reporter said to President Kennedy, after the big business had outmaneuvered Kennedy on some tax bill, I think it was, and so the reporter said, they're saying the big business has you where they want you, and Kennedy said, well, I can't believe I'm where big business wants me. I mean, standing there in the East Room of the White House. So, Obama is not where the radical right wants him.
You do a pretty good Kennedy, I might add.
Oh, but speaking of Kennedy, yesterday I couldn't help myself. We were standing around drinking champagne, and before everything started, and I was in the blue room with Franklin Kameny, was sitting on a blue sofa, looking very, very refined. And he's one of the pioneers of the gay rights movement, and he's 84 this year. But anyway, I started saying to people, I started my Jackie Kennedy impression, if you remember Von Meter's first family album back in 1962, and I said, we decided to leave it just the way it was when President Blue lived here in the blue room. But
So you were the life of the party. That's good. Rich, thanks very much for the call. We go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
All life is sacred. Thus, the joining together of man and woman is always honored. Apart, there is no life, but from such union, life may proceed.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
Is that all?
Yes, sir.
Well, you're entitled to your opinion. This country is not a theocracy, and different people have a different view of their religion. The fundamentalist approach to religion, where certain people claim as if they have some sort of ownership of faith and religion, is not shared by most of the people in this country. We have a First Amendment to the Constitution that guarantees religious freedom and that prohibits the government from establishing religion. And protects the free exercise, which could not possibly mean anything if it meant feel free to agree with the fundamentalists. There are no restrictions on heterosexual marriages of infertile couples, and nor are our marriage laws, our civil marriage laws, based on religious dictates. Nor is it the case that marriage has remained unchanged for millennia. The Old Testament has many cases of polygamy. And when you try to confront fundamentalists with that fact, they change the subject, because that alone causes their entire position to collapse, which is based upon a false claim of unchanging institution over millennia. In the past 50 years, the civil laws related to marriage in this country have changed dramatically. You had a series of crucial privacy-based Supreme Court rulings, starting with Griswold v. Connecticut in the 1960s, moving on to Eisenstadt v. Baird, through Roe v. Wade, and then in 2003 to Lawrence v. Texas, which was the sodomy case, and which clearly shows a line of privacy rights thinking based on constructive due process in the 14th Amendment that suggests that individual couples and individual people have a right to control their own bodies. And that is the law of the land here in this country. And many of us are quite determined to fight very hard to keep it that way.
I'm wondering what it does to all of your arguments and to this whole issue to have so much hypocrisy on the part of people who have in some instances, been at the forefront of anti-gay marriage, Defense of Marriage Act, et cetera, people who have cheated on their wives, and a lot of hypocrisy floating around, particularly in the last couple months in this country.
And what they will say, to try to give them as much benefit of the doubt as possible, is, well, but even if we lapse, you know, even if we slip and sin, the standards we are upholding are still true and good standards. And therefore, even though we are imperfect messengers, it's still a good message. I'm sorry. without a live and let live attitude, to some extent, society, if they're concerned about society collapsing, that is a problem for society if you have such a degree of intolerance. It's intolerance does more harm than a loving same-sex couple, in many cases raising a family, could possibly do. And this is what needs to be focused on. I actually think that the increase, at least at the moment, apparently increasing cases of rank hypocrisy on the part of right-wing political figures who advance their own careers by preaching this very rigid, narrow and intolerant concept of the family, and trying to use the power of the state to do harm to families of which they disapprove, that helps us because it exposes the thin foundation that these people are standing on. And the voters have flipped, I mean, what, at least half a dozen states flipped from red to blue last November. One of the things that made that was crucial there was that finally the Democrats had a leader who was not just eloquent and had progressive views, but was strong enough and cunning enough sufficiently skilled at organizing to outmaneuver not only the Clintons that he had to defeat, but and their political machine, but also the all-or-nothing left, as I put it, who would rather vote for a third-party candidate that they know has no chance of getting elected rather than vote for an imperfect Democrat. And an earlier caller, you know, by saying, well, he's not going to vote for Obama if, you know, he doesn't do whatever, that's an example of somebody that could end up harming our own cause and causing somebody even worse to be elected. And I don't think, you know, because the Republicans are worse, we should simply elect the Democrats, whatever, no matter what they do. I think we need to kick some butt in district after district and state after state and demand better, more of a backbone from members of Congress. But we should not make the perfect the enemy of the good. We all or nothing usually leads to nothing. I am, as an activist, have been doing this for nearly 30 years, and I have taken an incrementalist approach. And we are far better off now than we were 40 years ago.
Rick Rosendahl is our guest this hour, Vice President for Political Affairs, Gay and Lesbian Activist Alliance of Washington, D.C. He was among the over 250 gay activists who met with President Obama yesterday, as this whole week marks really the beginning of the gay rights movement with the raid on the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village back in 1969. All right, more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The next hour of our program today, our guest says American civilization has reached the end of its long ascendancy in the world, and the breakdown of American dominance can be seen across the military, political, economic, and cultural dimensions of influence. What's ahead for America and for the world? We'll be talking with Paul Starobin, whose latest book is After America, Narratives for the Next Global Challenge. All right, let's go back to phone calls now, and Barb from Chippewa Falls, our next caller. Hi, Barb.
Hi, and thank you for this program. I had a couple of comments. I've been working for gay rights issues for a very long time, 30-some years. My oldest son is 32. When I was working with the National Organization for Women back with the Equal Rights Amendment in the late 70s, through that organization and some other organizations that I worked with for all civil rights kinds of things, I never understood, never got the discrimination thing. There was always an assumption that because I was working for that, that I was a gay person. Mm. And at that time, I didn't say anything, but I'd write letters to the editor and whatever, and then so I would, get these comments, and people always thought, I guess, I was babysitting my own kids. But anyway, in more recent years, did a lot of door-to-doors for Fair Wisconsin to oppose discrimination and civil rights against gay people. During the last election cycle, and where I'm going with this is that I wanted to reiterate the guest's very important statement. I've been passionate about a lot of issues, and the whole all or none and going, not voting for somebody because they're not completely perfect, I totally agree with. We have to get people to sit down and just let their legislators know that they support this and that sort of thing. I wrote to Focus on the Family because I got a letter from them that blasted our area against state legislators who support gay rights, and that was, I guess, understood. Happened to be two Democrats over a two-election cycle for assembly in the legislature, and told me that there was a fellow by the name of Tim Gill that I never heard of in San Francisco who was trying to influence Wisconsin voters with outside activist money. And I saw where they were going with this, and this was this Tim Gill, I guess, is in favor of promoting the gay agenda, which I, don't get that term anyway. But so I wrote back, and I'm wondering, and I want your guest's opinion on, with the public being ahead of where legislators are, is there a level of denial in these strong anti-gay groups? Because I wrote to them saying that my husband and I don't support candidates who discriminate against any particular group, including race, gender, sexual preference. I listed the whole thing. I shortly after got a letter from Focus on the Family, Dr. Dobson, welcoming me to the ministry of the Focus on the Family in complete denial about my comments, and I continued to get anti-gay, anti-choice, different things from Focus on the Family. What I'm wondering is there a huge denial in these other groups that claim to be Christian and loving and whatever that the majority of the country is going in this direction? I cannot get them to understand that my voting does not go in that direction.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the years of support that you've given. Many people have put themselves on the line and taken heat from their neighbors and from others for standing up for what's right. It's focus on the family and groups like that are not just in denial; they're fanatics, and their whole position is based on a fundamental refusal to respect that other people have faiths, deeply felt faiths that are different from their own, and a refusal to recognize that this government that was founded, this country was founded on religious freedom. They are convinced that religious freedom is wickedness. At least that's they demonstrate that that's their attitude by the obsessive, aggressive way in which they try to force their views on everybody else using the powers of the state. They continually violate the command against bearing false witness by lying through their teeth. They know for sure that we are not talking about forcing ministers to preach a certain way, to accept certain marriages, or anything like that. They know that for sure by now. Every bill we pass, we include religious exemption language to make it absolutely unmistakably clear that we're not in any way intending, by providing civil equality on that account, to interfere with anybody's religious freedom. And they keep telling that lie because they think it works for them. It's working less and less. They've gone to the well once too often of trying to stir panic over gay families being a big threat to society. It's manifestly not true. And if you go to 538.com, Nate Silver, who's an expert polling analyst, shows the trend is working in our favor. And so I think we simply have to insist that we simply have to do more education. For example, the gay agenda is equal protection of the law. Any meeting has a meeting agenda. That doesn't necessarily imply some dastardly, secretive, sinister thing. Yes, we are for equal protection of the law. And it is as simple as that. It is the birthright of every American, and all we are asking for is the same protections that other people take for granted. And this is a very simple concept, and increasing numbers of voters are recognizing that.
Mm-hmm. Rick, can you explain the disparity? You mentioned young people's thoughts on this. The New York Times CBS poll not very long ago, just last spring, 57% of people under 40 supporting same-sex marriage, 31% of respondents over the age of 40. How do you explain that? Why are younger people much more accepting?
Because they've grown up in a society where they've seen gay people and gay families, and it's more visible culturally. And for the past 15 years or so, there's been a great deal of open public discussion about same-sex marriage, for example, and it's not some alien concept to them the way it may have been to people that grew up in the 60s or before. So I think it's partly simple familiarity. There's been more. Also, we have alternatives to the mainstream media these days, where people can find out a lot more information than you get over the broadcast channels. And so that has given people access to more information that way. So I think it's just a matter of the new generation coming along is more familiar with gay people, gay families. It's discussed more openly, without there being the same level of taboo against even any mention of it. And the more people become exposed to the reality of it, the less frightening and alien it seems.
Thanks, Barb, for your call. Scott from Green Bay, hello.
Good morning. I think, this just my opinion, I could be wrong, but I think a lot of it, we need to differentiate between same-sex marriage from a religious standpoint and a state standpoint. I think a lot of people see or view same-sex marriage from a religious standpoint and have issues with it, but wouldn't from a state recognition of it as opposed to a religious recognition of it. You know, my problem has always been, if from a religious standpoint, if I talk about it and I just happen to have different views than other people, I'm immediately labeled as a homophobe, which is frustrating from the point because I'm not, but just because my views are different than somebody else's that I get attacked for my views. And I'm not hostile about it, not aggressive, and not out there lobbying or campaigning against anybody, but immediately I'm attacked as a homophobe or a bigot. And the other question I have is from a civil rights standpoint, and nobody's really answered this question, and I'm just curious if I can get a yes or no. From a civil rights standpoint, if same-sex marriage is legalized, which I think it's a state's issue, and I don't really want to get involved. If the state wants to do it, that's fine.
It's a what issue?
What? State issue.
State's rights issue. Would it be acceptable for 3 or 4 people to get married? I mean, from a purely civil rights issue, I mean, if we're all righted the ability to get married, why couldn't 3 people get married? I mean, why couldn't there be polygamy?
I will accept that is an issue for gay people to answer if you can explain to me how it is any more applicable, that question, any more applicable to gay people than to straight people. Most polygamy as practiced, as actually existing, is heterosexual. To the extent that there's a problem with polygamy, it's been shown by experience to be a heterosexual problem. This kind of question is a red herring that is raised continually, and the implication behind it is that to make any change of any kind whatsoever requires making every conceivable change. I insist, even if you insist that it's not self-evident to you, I insist, every single citizen knows that it is plainly the case that it is obviously not true that making any change requires making all possible changes. That amounts to intellectual hysteria. Obviously, we have legislatures, right? And the only possible reason to have legislatures is to change laws. If you start with the assumption that everything the way it is perfectly fine, then why should we be wasting our tax money to pay for legislatures? So the whole purpose of legislatures is to make some kind of change to something, and we don't panic over that. Why? Because we can deliberate over it. We can discuss it. We propose and talk about making change A. And then we organize for it and press for it, and we vote and change the law to make one particular proposed change, not the infinite number of potential other changes, but only this one change. And gay people are asking for the same right as straight couples, not one single syllable more, just and only. Whatever you are allowed to do, let us do, period. And laws against polygamy do not restrict heterosexual people from marrying anybody. They just restrict them to marrying one person at a time. And gay people are not asking for the right to marry everybody. They're just asking the right to marry a single person that they love and who loves them back. And that helps society. It improves stability of society. It is a good thing. The evidence shows that people live longer and healthier lives and therefore are less a burden to, you know, the healthcare system if they have a loved one who cares for them and for whom they care. People's lives are extended longer. And now I think we should be able to disagree without attacking, without demonizing. But gay people have been the greater target of demonization here. And I've heard endlessly from people that they are polite in their disagreement, and then they're called anti-gay. However, the idea can scream, even if your voice remains quiet. If you are opposed to my civil, and I repeat, civil, not religious, civil, marriage equality, then that is by definition anti-gay. I don't know why there should be a concept of being anti-gay if that isn't anti-gay. If you oppose my civil marriage equality, not talking about churches, civil marriage equality, and you're opposing that, then you're anti-gay by definition. Maybe you should be to that extent. Maybe you should be anti-gay to that extent if you're convinced that it's harmful to society or whatever to allow us to marry on the equal terms to straight couples. But it is anti-gay. And I'm sorry. If it may harm my cause to say that, because many of my colleagues say we shouldn't say that because it turns people off. Excuse me. I am 53 years old. I love somebody that I met in another country. We have remained a couple and committed to each other for 8 years, despite all of the burdens, financially and emotional, that my half dozen siblings have not had to face. They were all able to marry in their 20s, and it has taken me 3 decades longer than my siblings to find a committed relationship, and we still have to face all of these extra obstacles, and there's something really wrong, it seems to me, if somebody can't understand the level of passion that exists on the part of many people in our community who are fed up with still having to fight decade after decade for simple rights that other people take for granted, and we are fed up with being treated as if we're a big threat to society. And if you're going to be upset with us, please feel compelled to be more upset with the radical religious right that does insist upon using the power of the state to deny equal protection to other people. We have been used in every even-numbered year when the Republicans were in power.
We
were demonized with constitutional amendments to stir up voter turnout on the social right, to throw elections. It's not because the people pushing those referenda were so extreme. They were simply political operatives exploiting the social right, and it has caused harm to this country far more than the harm they claim we are posing.
Thank you so much for being with us this hour. Thank you.
Thank
Our guest this hour, Rick Rosendahl. He is Vice President for Political Affairs, Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance of Washington. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, and thanks to Jolema Noel for on-air production.